A steam train chugs past.
On the 8th of November, 1918, three men met in a railway carriage in the woods in northern France. They were there to negotiate the end of the First World War.
This is a dark day with tension, as this is the greatest war the world has seen thus far.
Archive film of battles, then a modern reconstruction.
Their meeting lasted 3 days. At stake were hundreds of thousands of lives. Leading historians from each country have taken us inside the minds of those involved.
Foch keeps saying to the British, "My country was devastated. Yours wasn't."
Too much bonhomie is not going to get you very far in this.
People of 70 million can suffer, but we will not die. You will not get rid of us.
The results of the meeting would echo down through the 20th century, often with terrible consequences. Now, exactly 100 years later, this is the story of that meeting. This is the story of the armistice of 1918.
Plain white letters on a black background. WW1, the final hours. A large house in rolling countryside.
In 1918, German military headquarters were in Spa, in occupied Belgium.
Soaring away from a town over pine trees. 12 p.m., November 7th. Then gliding under trees on a country road.
It was from here, at 12 noon, on November the 7th, that the Germans set off for the negotiations to end the First World War.
In an open car,
leading the delegation was a mild-mannered former schoolteacher turned politician, Matthias Erzberger.
Professor Anika Mombauer.
Matthias Erzberger is courageous and selfless. He is a man of conviction and not a game player. He looks like a kindly man. I think of him as a good German.
A white flag on the car.
To get to the negotiating table, Erzberger had to take a 200-mile road trip and cross enemy lines. On the way, his car crashed, and he had to change vehicles. It felt like a bad omen.
A map of the journey.
At La Capelle, he reached the front line, where he had to hand himself over to the French. Here, before the negotiations had even begun, the French made their first psychological move.
An armed soldier blocks their way.
They took him on a detour, a guided tour, of the horrors of the Western Front.
The soldier keeps his weapon aimed at Erzberger as he approaches at dusk with the white flag. Then a film of a man shouldering a comrade.
The war had been raging for 4 years.
Medics and ambulances.
With soldiers dying at the rate of 1,000 a day.
A wounded man is carried on a stretcher. Two still soldiers lying in a field, then a row of corpses.
It's important to remember that people like Erzberger, who were in Berlin for the war, had never seen what the front looked like. The destruction that he witnesses is really extremely harrowing.
Soldiers picking through the rubble of a building, then a soldier lying motionless on the ground.
He writes, "It was worse than being on his son's deathbed, his young son's deathbed, who died of the Spanish flu just some 3 weeks before."
A man carrying another.
Seeing firsthand the devastation that German troops had actually caused in Belgium and France, I think for him would have been very shocking.
A photo of a soldier's body lying across a barbed wire fence, then steaming piles of mud against a backdrop of a dirty orange sky. A steam train on a single-track country line.
At 3 a.m., Erzberger boarded a train with blacked-out windows. 4 hours later, it pulled into an empty railroad siding, deep in the forest of Compiègne.
A photo of the carriages.
Waiting for him were two men who could not have been more different from the German.
A man getting dressed.
Britain had sent Rosalind Weems, who joined the military at just 13 and grew up to be commander of the most powerful navy in the world.
Rosie Weems is the right man in the right place in 1918. He has self-confidence and that fluency and ease of manner.
Weems was knighted for his actions in Gallipoli. He was well-connected and politically astute.
He has a capacity, it seems to me, to bring out the best in other people as well as in himself.
Battleships.
For over 100 years, Britain had ruled the waves, and Weems' main interest was keeping it that way.
For Britain, one of the key concerns is the need for a lead after the war over Germany to ensure the security of the empire, which will underpin, as he would see it, Britain's prosperity.
A reconstruction of Weems tucking his cap under his arm, then a French general fastening his belt.
France sent Marshal Ferdinand Foch in charge of all the Allied armies. A short man with a fondness for cheap cigars. His only son was killed by the Germans in 1914. But he only grieved for half an hour before getting back to work.
General Foch is a professional, cold, proud. Foch is all about fighting for the fatherland. Allons-y, let's go, let's attack. Foch keeps saying to the British, I have a bleeding country. My country was devastated, yours wasn't. My country is bleeding. I know, because I am bleeding, because I am wounded.
So, Foch wanted one thing more than anything else. To make sure that Germany was never able to invade France again.
Foch walks out of his quarters.
Of the three of them, Erzberger was by far in the most desperate position. For years, the Western Front had been locked in stalemate. Millions had died, but the front line had only moved a few miles in either direction.
A man slides into a trench of corpses.
Then, in early 1918, German stormtroopers smashed through Allied lines. But they went too far, too fast, and supply lines couldn't keep up. With the help of American troops, the Allies launched a decisive counterattack. Soon, German troops were deserting in droves, and there was unrest on the streets of Berlin.
Blades of grass in railway line ballast.
7 a.m. on the 8th of November. And in just 2 hours, the armistice negotiations would begin.
Paper and pencils have been placed in front of chairs at a long table adorned with a small lamp in a wood-paneled railway carriage.
Erzberger arrives at the armistice negotiations not exactly in the best physical and psychological frame of mind, really, to undertake these momentous negotiations.
French soldiers stand to attention for Foch.
Foch shows up, looking like a statue of himself. perfectly shaved, his moustache perfectly groomed.
Foch appears in Erzberger's account as very aloof, very cool, and Erzberger is unimpressed with Foch's manners. Also, not terribly won over by Weems. He was essentially like a fish out of water, I guess, being a civilian in this military environment.
Erzberger is watching Foch and Weems. Sir Hugh Strachan.
These are the enemy. You do need to be pretty firm, pretty strong. And too much bonhomie is not going to get you very far in this. Each group facing the other across the table, divided, crucially, by the table, not united by the table. This is not a dinner party where people are leaning across. They're looking at each other pretty stony-faced with a sense of tension, as this is the greatest war the world has seen thus far.
Erzberger expects there to be a handshake. There is no handshake. There are no friendly formalities.
The very fact that Foch doesn't want to shake hands with the Germans indicates that, in his eyes, the horror of the war goes far beyond the normal rules or conventions of chivalry. And he wants to show the Germans that this war has gone far too far, that something was broken in civilization or in humankind.
Erzberger's first move was a humanitarian one. He requested a ceasefire whilst negotiations took place.
Archive images of Tommies going over the top and being cut down by shellfire.
Foch refused.
Film of soldiers emerging from trenches, then Erzberger taking papers from a briefcase.
Erzberger's next move was to point to a peace proposal laid out by the American president, Woodrow Wilson. The proposal set out a new world order and was known as the 14 Points.
Crowds cheering Wilson.
Its aim was to place all countries on an equal footing and spread the American values of democracy and peace.
Professor Jay Winter.
Wilson's 14 points were his dream. He was a constitutional historian, the only American president with a PhD. He was a learned man. He understood these issues. Arrogance, perhaps. Vision, certainly. Humility, not really.
Erzberger assumes that this will be a matter of negotiation to agree an armistice along the lines of Wilson's suggestions. He has lots of ideas of how he thinks he might use the 14 points as a vehicle for trying to arrange a favorable peace for Germany.
The proposals by Wilson are very nice and very interesting, but they miss the point. The point is ending the war and breaking the German might.
Quickly, Foch and Weems disabuse them of the notion that the 14 points will be the basis of the armistice talks.
Erzberger's memoirs give a sense of the confusion, I think, and surprise also, that he clearly felt, given the position he now finds himself in.
Foch and Weems put forward their own terms.
Surrender weapons.
First, they wanted the German weapons. 2,000 planes, 5,000 artillery pieces, and 30,000 machine guns.
Those very high numbers, they are there to crush the Germans, to make the German army unable to fight.
Then they wanted their navy. 10 battleships, 14 cruisers, 50 destroyers, and 160 submarines.
Weems is making sure that the ships are delivered to the British, so they cannot be used again. That's end of story.
Erzberger would have been aware that this will be considered an absolute outrage by everyone in Germany, and they certainly did not want to hand their beautiful fleet over to Britain.
The German Navy will be reduced to a point of ineffectiveness.
A battleship at sea.
And the Allies wanted land. The long-disputed areas of Alsace and Lorraine. 5,000 square miles of fertile territory that both France and Germany believed was theirs. They also demanded to occupy a piece of Germany, the Rhineland.
The first reason is technical and military. It's a bridgehead to the German territory. That's the first thing. The second reason is psychological. For 4 years, the Germans have been occupying France. Foch, by sending his troops over to Germany, wants to show the Germans that from then on, they are occupied themselves.
And they wanted money. Germany must pay reparations for all the damage done in the war.
The notion that the defeated power should pay for defeat has been well established in European practice before 1918. The point is there that if you lose a war, you pay.
I think what Erzberger worries about more than anything else is that if Germany does not agree to the armistice conditions, it would be occupied, it would be divided by the Allies, it would be completely destroyed. I think it dawns on him then that this really is the end of the road.
Erzberger focused on the thing that mattered most to the German people, the naval blockade of their country.
Continue naval blockade.
In place since 1914, a blockade of its ports was preventing food and supplies from reaching the German people.
Erzberger pleads with them. He says, look, Germans are starving. But there is no pity in that railway carriage for starving Germans at that point.
Weems doesn't give any indication that he's concerned about the German civilian population.
In continuing the blockade, Foch and Weems' aim was strategic. The Allies wanted a way to maintain the upper hand over Germany, even if it meant hundreds of thousands of civilians would starve to death.
The blockade is hostile, there's no doubt about that, and it's designed to be hostile. What Foch and Weems are trying to do is to continue to exert pressure in order to make sure that they get the right outcome at the peace settlement. For Weems, the moment to get Germany is at the armistice. This is the moment.
The continuation of the blockade was a major blow for Erzberger.
Foch sees some German delegate crying, but what is the weight of some tears of the German politician in front of him compared to the 1.5 million dead people in France? What does it weigh compared to the 15% of the French territory that were devastated by the German? I mean, nothing.
When all the conditions had been read out, Erzberger was asked if he would agree to the armistice terms on behalf of Germany.
For Erzberger, this is a really difficult position to be in because, of course, he is also a patriotic German. He does not want to put his name to something that is going to be so hateful to many, many Germans, because this really spells defeat for Germany.
Erzberger had been presented with tougher terms than he could possibly have imagined. Then, Foch and Weems told him he had just 72 hours to decide. Erzberger had to give them an answer by the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. But he didn't have the authority to just sign away the future of his country. The terms were too long to encrypt and radio back, so a document had to be sent all the way to German High Command at Spa. A journey of over 200 miles back across the Western Front.
A red line traces the journey across a map from Compiègne to Spa.
Erzberger tries to negotiate on this with Foch and says, look, we're going to struggle to make this deadline, and Foch is nonplussed, really, says that that's your problem.
Foch is inflexible about the deadline because it's part of the game. It's part of showing the enemy that he sets the rules.
Professor Johann Chaputo. The white flag flies as a car is driven along a country road by a soldier, then Erzberger standing alone.
It's an agonizing wait, during which time Erzberger has a lot of time to reflect on how he had got to that point.
The clever son of a tailor, Erzberger was a self-made man.
The journey that he had to being the Imperial German representative at these armistice negotiations is actually quite staggering. He really, in a sense, pulled himself by his bootstrings.
Erzberger knew that back in Germany, there were many people who weren't going to take these terms well. People like the strategic mastermind of the German army, General Erich Ludendorff.
I see in Ludendorff a man who is convinced that the normal state is war, that peace is unnormal, it is only a time between two wars. A social Darwinist who believes in the benefit of wars over humanity.
Ludendorff detested politicians like Erzberger, yet was, in part, responsible for sending him to Compiègne. When Ludendorff realized that Germany was losing the war, he didn't want the military to have to carry the can.
A photo of Ludendorff.
Ludendorff was seeking for a scapegoat for putting the blame of a defeat on shoulders that so far had no say in this war.
Professor Gerhard Hirschfeld.
Now the people who had, as he phrased it, boiled the soup, they should eat it. He was clearly using these people to say they brought us into the mess, should now actually get us out of it.
2 a.m., November 9th.
That's why Erzberger had been sent to negotiate.
Erzberger lights a cigarette and stares pensively out of the carriage as raindrops stream down the window. Then archive images of a burst of light over a big gun and a still photo of a man by a car.
The messenger had been delayed by the chaos of the Western Front, where the German army was being pushed back, but was putting up a fight.
The car travelling at night with blazing headlamps.
He spent hours struggling to find a route through no man's land to German territory.
A photo of the driver in a peaked cap with a passenger holding the flag. Then Erzberger puffing on his cigarette.
Erzberger is just desperate for news, desperate for an authorization or some sort of guidance as to what he should do. He needed that answer back. By this point, Erzberger will have been just exhausted, not knowing how these negotiations will eventually pan out. I think he must have been basically just at the end of his tether.
Weems resting in his carriage compartment.
Weems has every reason to be nervous about whether these terms will stick. there is a real possibility that the Germans might actually not sign an armistice. If the terms are too draconian, then why shouldn't they dig in to get ready to continue the conflict into 1919? So Weems has good reason to be concerned.
Awaiting news in London was the man who sent Weems to Compiègne, British Prime Minister David Lloyd George.
Lloyd George is a bit of a chancer, a gambler, I'd say, and he was ruthless. He grew up without much money. He didn't go to university. He was this figure who had come from the ranks, and I think he was someone who felt that he was a man of destiny, that his hour had come.
Lloyd George saw the armistice as a chance to crown his political career, to win the war for Britain, and keep him at number 10.
He was a politician to his fingertips. He gets elected to the House of Commons at 27 and is there for 55 years. I think he was a humane, compassionate man. And he felt that we needed to stop the war because people were dying and it seemed like a futile exercise. David Lloyd George is very much seen as the man who can get the war to a successful conclusion.
Dr. Kwasi Kanteng.
A conclusion that was up to Weems to deliver.
Gliding over Berlin.
Extraordinarily, just as the messenger was stuck on the Western Front, events in Germany were unfolding at an incredible pace. That day, riots turned to revolution. Armed protesters took to the streets of Berlin, furious at lives lost in a futile war. They were threatening to shoot up the city unless heads rolled. Ludendorff was a frightened man.
He immediately left Berlin, went into hiding.
A huge mob descended on the Reichstag and demanded the politicians got rid of the Kaiser and brought the war to an end. Parliament contacted German High Command at Spa. Either the Kaiser abdicated within minutes or Berlin would fall to the revolution. The commander of the army, General Paul von Hindenburg, with tears in his eyes, met with Kaiser Wilhelm. At 3 p.m., the Kaiser abdicated. Germany was now a republic.
Looking up at the Grand House in Spa.
So remarkably, when the messenger finally arrived with the armistice terms, it was no longer clear who was in charge.
11 a.m. on a rainy day.
10th of November. In just 24 hours, the deadline given to Erzberger would pass.
For Weems, the worry in Compiègne when the news of the revolution comes through is that there will be no government, and with no government, Germany will not be able to agree terms. It won't have a recognised authority and a legal authority to do that.
With no response from Germany, Weems' fears seem to be confirmed. At 6:30 p.m., Foch sent a message to Erzberger, reminding him the time was almost up.
The very fact that the Kaiser is abdicating, as far as Foch is concerned, means the German army is not able to resist a strong attack from the Allies.
Foch saw opportunity.
He's studying a map with a subordinate.
He had hundreds of thousands of men and 600 tanks awaiting the order to attack the German line.
For him, it will be a cup of tea. Foch knows that first, the German army is at the end of its capacities, and second, that there is a revolution in Germany. So Foch is convinced that the Germans will yield and will accept each and every condition.
Weems, too, was thinking strategically. So far, the war had not presented him with a decisive naval victory like Nelson's at Trafalgar.
Weems feels frustrated that there has been no battle of Trafalgar. And says, you know, we will deliver Trafalgar. We will deliver the outcome at the armistice.
Lloyd George also wanted to use the armistice to reassert Britain's role at sea and help secure its empire.
The British strategy was Britannia rules the waves. So it made sense to essentially defang Germany, to remove all the naval infrastructure they'd built up to prevent them from starting a war, starting that kind of arms race again.
On the train, a radio operator taps a Morse key.
At 9 p.m., a message arrived for Erzberger.
The operator jots it down and hands it to a comrade.
It was from German High Command. General Hindenburg told Erzberger to try and get concessions from the Allies, but if he couldn't, sign anyway.
For Erzberger, the highest military leader in the land does not feel we can continue fighting. So he's not being told, do what you can, but otherwise we'll carry on. There's a clear message that try and get the best outcome you can. This armistice gives clear conditions which are difficult to swallow, and Erzberger was under no illusions even at the time that this walk of the cross, as he called it in his memoirs, would be his cross to bear.
A photograph of Erzberger sitting at a desk, then archive images of dirt from shell explosions raining down on the trenches.
November 11th, 1918. The war continued with unremitting savagery. 2,738 soldiers lost their lives on this last day of the First World War.
2:15 a.m., November 11th.
Shortly after 2 in the morning, with just hours left before the deadline, negotiations finally began in earnest. Erzberger only had a few short hours left to fight his corner, with the fate of his nation on his shoulders.
By this point, Erzberger has been essentially on the road for 4 days. So he will have had a little bit of sleep on and off. Certainly not in a position to argue as forcefully and well as he might have under better circumstances. As far as Erzberger is concerned, it's very much a case of damage limitation.
Erzberger picked his fights carefully. He had three priorities.
Surrender weapons.
Foch had demanded the German army hand over 30,000 machine guns. But Hindenburg told Erzberger the army needed weapons to quell the revolution that was still threatening to tear the country apart.
Erzberger tries very hard in these negotiations, these very uneven negotiations, to make little tweaks at least to the conditions of the armistice.
Foch was now so sure of victory, he agreed to reduce the number of machine guns by 5,000. Foch also agreed to Erzberger's request to decrease the Allied occupation east of the Rhine by 30 kilometers. Erzberger had at least secured some concessions.
He's proud of that. His memoirs reflect this. The fact that he, you know, I managed at least to get them to reduce the zone of occupation by a few kilometers, or to reduce the amount of military hardware we have to hand over. He lists all this. These were my achievements.
Next, Erzberger turned to the naval demands. Weems had insisted that the German Navy hand over 160 of its prized submarines.
Erzberger knows that this was perhaps the most unpalatable for the military and naval elites in Germany, because the Navy at that point had not been defeated in war, and it was just a complete surrender that essentially hands Britain the German Navy on a plate.
Right up until the end, there is a fear that the German Navy will come out and be a real threat to Britain through the submarine campaign. And certainly in Weems's mind, as he reports it, there is no scope for negotiation. It is take it or leave it.
Weems had asked for 160 submarines because he hoped that would account for most, if not all, of them. He was told Germany didn't have that many, so he said he would take whatever they had.
160 becomes all.
At the stroke of a pen, Weems secured the entire U-boat fleet and his decisive naval victory.
Weems has a sense of a sort of, I suppose, both impishness and celebration when he realises that by getting his figures wrong, he's actually got the right result. You know, there's no attempt to pretend he had greater knowledge than he did, no attempt to say that this was the result of superior wisdom. But it is a reflection, of course, of his determination to make sure that this is the outcome.
Then Erzberger made his most important request. He pleaded with them to lift the naval blockade that was killing innocent German civilians. But Foch and Weems refused.
High-speed images of racing dark clouds turning gold, then white as the sun rises. 5:15 a.m., November 11th. A French typist is at work.
At 5:15 a.m., the terms of the armistice were finally agreed.
He pauses to look at notes.
Not wanting to delay the end of the war a moment longer. Incredibly, only the last page of the agreement was typed out for the men to sign.
The typist hands a paper to a colleague, and it's passed to Weems, who removes a monocle from his right eye, studies it, then picks up a pen and dips it in an inkwell. An animation of his signature and rank appears on a facsimile of the document.
You might think that Weems, having had no sleep, would have felt exhausted, emotionally drained, ready to go to bed. It's not what he says. What he says is, this is wonderful. This is, you know, we've got there. This is a moment of success, a moment of real achievement.
Foch taps his pen nib on the edge of the well, and an animation of his name appears on the document above Weems.
For Foch, after 4 years of total war, of a horrible war, what he feels is victory. This is victory.
Erzberger signed on behalf of Germany.
I think Erzberger is in no doubt that signing the armistice will expose him to a tirade of hatred from those who felt that Germany should have continued to fight. As he signs that document, I'm sure he must have realized how fateful that action was for Germany and for himself personally. Erzberger says to Foch, people of 70 million can suffer, but we will not die, you will not get rid of us. So a final act of defiance, perhaps. To which Foch simply replies, très bien, very well.
Erzberger clutching the document, then a pistol firing. A photo of the two senior officers.
Foch and Weems posed for this photograph on the steps of the carriage. Erzberger wasn't asked to be in it.
In a photo, Foch stares sternly while Weems smiles as they stand on the track ballast in front of the carriage. They're flanked by British naval men and a French officer, while three more French men pose on the carriage steps.
The train left Compiègne and headed for Paris.
Men wave from the train as it pulls out of the station, and a soldier on the track waves and blows a kiss to the camera.
Aboard, a complete copy of the armistice was finally typed out. Starting with the time hostilities would cease.
A British soldier shows off a message.
Every unit along the Western Front was ordered to stop shooting at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918.
A soldier's watch reads 10:45. Then a group of men grin and wave their tin hats in the air.
War was replaced by peace. Despair by hope.
Other troops toss their hats in the air and dance. A man shakes the hand of a former enemy on the battlefield, and a soldier swaps a field cap for another man's peaked hat.
News of the armistice travelled quickly around the globe. The people of Paris, who just a few months earlier were almost in reach of the German guns, breathed a collective sigh of relief. French Prime Minister Clemenceau had been supportive of his army, urging them to fight on, even during the darkest moments of the war. Now, at the outbreak of peace, crowds rushed to embrace him.
Clemenceau was really happy. For the first time in his life, he was almost speechless, and it was the feeling of victory for France and the success of his policy.
In London, thousands poured onto the streets in a spontaneous celebration. The royal family waved from the balcony. Then the tidal wave of joy moved to Downing Street, where David Lloyd George was waiting.
For Lloyd George, it was a moment of great exultation. It was probably the finest moment in his career. The appalling slaughter had come to an end. And it was a great moment for the country. We defeated the German Empire, and the British Empire stood really at the head of the world.
In America, it was party time.
Crowds in the streets are waving US flags, and the air is filled with slips of paper.
An impromptu ticker tape parade attracted thousands in New York.
Smiling women in fancy dress and a man blowing a horn, gliding over Washington, D.C.
Wilson's reaction was one of exhilaration. He made the United States into a carrier of a message that the world order could be changed.
This may not have been the armistice that Wilson proposed, but it was peace nonetheless.
A man holds up a paper with the headline, "Germany surrenders."
The Allies weren't the only ones celebrating.
The Brandenburg Gate.
Even for the Germans, the end of such a bloody conflict was initially met with relief. Around the time the guns fell silent, Erzberger arrived at Spa to report back to German high command.
Erzberger is congratulated by Hindenburg for having done such a good job. And others in the delegation also point out that he fought like a lion, says one of the men who was there, to try and get the best deal possible for Germany. So there is a sense that his efforts are appreciated. Erzberger's memoirs make the point they knew it was the only thing I could have done.
A modern reconstruction of a World War I trench.
For those actually in the trenches, the end of the war brought a complex mix of emotions.
The silence was, I can only describe it as terrible. Everything dropped away from me. I thought, now what do I do now? There's no objective, there's nothing in front of us. I've just got to wait.
A photo of smiling soldiers.
You were scared stiff. In the trench, you were all right. If you kept down, sniper couldn't get you.
A light at the end of a dimly lit tunnel.
those that didn't come back. That's the people that should be honored. Those that didn't, they gave their life, and that is it.
Four soldiers carry a laden stretcher, then drifting towards the Palace of Versailles in France.
As the world began to dust itself off after 4 years of war, the main architects of the armistice, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Wilson, travelled to Paris to turn its sketched-out clauses into the terms for a permanent peace. Later known as the Treaty of Versailles. The terms Erzberger had agreed to at Compiègne had been quickly set in motion, and the consequences were already starting to unfold. Britain's Admiral Weems had demanded the Germans make the largest surrender in naval history.
Soaring over a coastline.
After the armistice, the entire German fleet had sailed across the North Sea to Britain to hand itself over to the Royal Navy.
The German Imperial flag flying from a ship.
Weems did regard what he'd achieved as a naval victory and was anxious to present it as that. The German Navy is handed over, to all intents and purposes, lock, stock and barrel, to Britain.
For some of Germany's sailors, the humiliation was unbearable, so they decided to sink their own ships.
Old footage of listing submarines side by side.
The entire German Navy was lost, just off the north coast of Scotland.
A photo of a lone figure sitting on a headland, with ships belching smoke in the distance.
The sinking of the German Navy, from all accounts we have, was an extremely traumatic event. The naval officers were absolutely devastated at this happening. And they blamed Erzberger personally for signing the armistice, for handing over the Navy to Britain.
Reparations. A photo of men collecting for the Soldiers for Self-Support Society.
Europe, after the war, was broke.
A photo of a large building partially reduced to rubble.
In France, Clemenceau started to take stock of what was left of his nation.
France was a country which most suffered from devastations and destructions of houses, of fields, of factories. So the question of reparation was the crucial question for all French people. And the main motto in France would be, German will pay.
In Britain too, tens of thousands of wounded soldiers and war widows desperately needed financial support.
The country is in a big amount of debt. It's borrowed huge amounts of money to finance the war. Lloyd George says, let the Germans pay for all the damage and destruction they've wrought. Lloyd George says they will pay to the utmost farthing, the Germans will pay to the utmost farthing. He's swept up by his own rhetoric.
However, if Britain or France had troubles, it was nothing compared to Germany. The reparations they had to pay, combined with the naval blockade, led to a humanitarian disaster. At least 300,000 men, women and children died as a result of malnutrition.
For Erzberger, the fact that he hadn't been able to take out the continuation of the blockade would have worried him, because hundreds of thousands of German women and children continue to starve.
German crowds protesting.
The backlash against the armistice steadily grew.
German police on horseback, then civilians firing weapons. A panicking crowd, then a photo of Ludendorff posing with the dog.
And the warlord, General Erich Ludendorff, started to rewrite history. He now claimed that the German army was not defeated in the war, and that Erzberger betrayed the trust of his country when he signed the armistice.
The accusation that Erzberger had stabbed Germany in the back obviously was upsetting for him because he had acted in the best way he thought he could to save Germany. Erzberger becomes one of the most hated men of the new republic. There are countless articles written against him, books published against him. He is absolutely vilified and aware of it.
At the signing of the treaty.
Knowing that Germany had borne the brunt of the armistice terms, Wilson tried to ensure at Versailles that some concessions were made, such as the French occupation of the Rhineland being declared temporary. But the Allies did impose a final, additional clause. Article 231, the notorious War Guilt Clause.
Germany had to accept sole responsibility for the outbreak of war, and that was something that basically nobody in Germany was willing to accept, Erzberger included. The reparations on their own, well, have been a pill that could have been swallowed, but combining it with this allocation of blame and of guilt caused an uproar in Germany.
Men in frock coats with top hats.
Despite the uproar, threatened with the resumption of hostilities, the Germans had little option but to sign. There were fierce critics on the Allied side, too.
Foch saw the Versailles Treaty not as a peace treaty, which would settle things forever.
Foch angrily flung papers around the railway carriage.
And I quote here, merely an armistice for 20 years. For Foch, it was the worst solution ever. In his eyes, it is obvious that Germany is still existing and the conditions of the peace treaty being far too harsh. The Germans, of course, will want to take revenge, of course.
Erzberger looks around warily as he walks through the woods.
Revenge, too, was a concern for Erzberger.
Erzberger knew that his life was in danger. There had been several attempts on his life. A hand grenade was thrown into his office in the Reichstag, and he was shot outside the courtroom and injured. His friends are worried for him. He's advised to learn to shoot a gun to defend himself, which he refuses to do. When Erzberger is assassinated, he's still a young man with a young daughter of 7 years old.
A headline in the Chicago Daily reads, Erzberger assassinated, shot 12 times.
Erzberger's assassins were former German naval officers who were still bitter about being forced to hand over their ships by the armistice.
It seems very tragic, Erzberger's fate, because he does seem to be somebody who puts his convictions before his own personal advantage. Erzberger is very much a person who did the right thing, and he did it really selflessly.
Photographs of a horse-drawn hearse and men in black marching at Erzberger's funeral.
Meanwhile, General Erich Ludendorff returned to public life, throwing his weight behind a new political movement.
A photograph of Ludendorff posing in uniform with a young Adolf Hitler sporting slicked black hair and a toothbrush moustache. A flag sporting the Nazi swastika fluttering in the wind, and ranks of brown shirts marching along city tramlines. A man sitting in a doorway with his head bowed.
In the 1920s and 30s, the resentment created by the harsh conditions imposed on Germany proved fertile ground for the far right.
A crowd returning Hitler's outstretched arm salute.
Und
Hitler, a Lance Corporal during the First World War, claimed to have wept when he heard the armistice had been signed. Once in power, he systematically dismantled the peace settlement.
Adoring crowds reach up to Hitler's podium, and the picture freezes on him giving the salute. High-speed images of dark clouds gathering in an ominous sky.
In France, the train on which the armistice was signed had been treasured as a monument to German defeat. They added a statue of Foch and a memorial featuring a slain German eagle. In June 1940, as Europe descended into the Second World War, Hitler took a very public revenge.
The Nazi flag is unfurled, covering the Foch monument.
The Führer with his generals passes along in front of the Guard of Honor and salutes.
The railway carriage stands alone in an open space. Hitler and his generals climb aboard and explore.
He demanded that the French surrender to him here. In the very carriage where Erzberger, Foch and Weems met in 1918.
Hitler takes a seat at the carriage table.
With their leader, General Hunziker, the French delegation arrives.
The French delegate glances nervously at the camera before sitting.
After reading of the preamble of the German conditions, the Führer leaves Compiègne.
Slow motion images of Hitler stepping down from the carriage and putting on a glove.
And many felt that the connection is more than symbolic, that the end of the First World War, the suffering and humiliation the Germans felt, was a cause of the next World War.
Drifting down to ranks of crosses in a war cemetery.
Those who had fought in the trenches had a clear message.
I don't think there should be any wars. I don't believe in them. Although as a soldier, I don't believe in them. Not after what I've seen, anyway.
The age between 17 and 23 or 24, and you had to be fighting in a war. There's no doubt about it that the cream age, were killed unnecessarily. What for?
It's painful. I got three mates buried somewhere. I don't know where. It's too many.